KALW.
I mean, the amount of bombs that they have dropped on this tiny little area in 6 weeks is more than the United States dropped on all of Afghanistan at the height of the war in an entire year.
Today, the death toll for Palestinians is accelerating far faster than it did 75 years ago.
Number of people killed so far, in the case of the Palestinians, is the second highest death toll in the entire history since 1948.
We hear a conversation about Palestine's historical struggle for statehood. Then we'll hear a story from our new series, Culture Keepers.
What I love most about it and what it's meant to me is not only acceptance and inclusion in this community, but like freedom of expression and almost like encouragement.
A glimpse into a local goth venue. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The ongoing Israeli offensive in Gaza has evoked memories of events that happened 75 years ago that resulted in the mass expulsion of Palestinians and the birth of the modern state of Israel. Columbia professor Rashid Khalidi is considered by many as one of the leading authors on the Palestinian identity and the national struggle for statehood. Today, we start the show with a conversation between Professor Khalidi and KALW News editor Sunni Khalid. And he begins by asking about the historical similarities and differences between the events of 1948 and today. And a note to our listeners, this interview took place early last week, and the casualties referenced have since gone up.
It's part of the same process of ethnic cleansing and squeezing the Palestinians into smaller and smaller areas of Palestine, or if possible, expelling them. In 1948, 750,000 people were expelled from what became the State of Israel. In 1967, 200,000, 250,000 were expelled. And what has happened so far in Gaza is that about 1.7 million of the 2.3 million people in the Gaza Strip have been forced by bombing to move from the northern part of the Strip into the southern part of the Strip. So ethnic cleansing in 1948, ethnic cleansing in 1967, in those cases, out of Israel. And today, what's been happening is forcing people from one part of the Gaza Strip into another part of the Gaza Strip. But there's a fear that Israel will attempt to expel them entirely into Sinai, into Egypt, or into Jordan. There's a fear among Palestinians, there's a fear among Egyptians, there's a fear among Jordanians that that may be in store. And Israeli leaders are openly talking about another Nakba, another catastrophe for the Palestinians, which entails their being driven out. So in that respect, it's similar. It's different in many respects. The number of people killed so far, Palestinians killed, and also for that matter, Israelis, in the case of the Palestinians, is the second highest death toll in the entire history since 1948, 20,000 Palestinians were killed. So far, 13,000 have been killed. 1948, this killing took place over a year. This has been 6 weeks that 13,000 people have been killed and 30,000 people made wounded. As far as Israel is concerned, the 800 or so Israeli civilians who were killed in a very short period of time is probably the highest civilian death toll in Israel's history, up to and including the 1948 war.
We're also not talking about Gaza exclusively. There have been a number of attacks against Palestinian communities in the West Bank. Do you see this as part of the same struggle, or is this different?
It's integral to a larger vision of reducing the Arab population of Palestine, which was a vision of the earliest Zionist leaders. Theodor Herzl, who's the founder of modern political Zionism, in his diary said, we're going to spirit the penniless population discreetly across the borders. Well, it wasn't done very discreetly. I mean, F-16s aren't very discreet. And what happened in 1948 wasn't very discreet, or in 67. But that has been a drive ever since the beginning of the Zionist project. You can't create a majority Jewish state in a land that has an Arab majority without reducing that majority. It's inevitable and necessary if that's your objective. So what's going on in the West Bank is integral to that, taking as much land as possible with as few Palestinians. 16 small rural communities have been ethnically cleansed since the 6th of October, maybe a couple thousand people. have been forced out of their homes, and their land and their homes have been destroyed by rampaging settlers backed by the Israeli army in the southern part of the West Bank and in the Jordan River Valley to the east of the West Bank, eastern part of the West Bank. So yes, that is part of the same process. Absolutely.
When you see the scenes of the kind of bombardment and the suffering that's going on in Gaza, about 41 years ago, you were living in Beirut, Lebanon, during the Israeli invasion and occupation. Right. How difficult is it for you to see those scenes? And what are your thoughts about when you see this being replayed?
You know, my wife and I were both there with two of our children. She was saying to me the other day, it's very painful to watch this, but in a way it's worse being at such a remove, at such a distance. When you're there with other people enduring bombardment or deprivation, you know, there's a kind of sense of solidarity. We're all in it together. I have my niece's in-laws are all in Gaza, and I have other family there. And it's so hard to be at a distance and watch this happen and have to wait for fragmentary news. Are they okay? Did they move from their house in Gaza City to this refugee camp in the south? And so on. Nothing that we went through. I mean, electricity was cut off, water was cut off, fuel was cut off, food, medicine, all of that. But it was nothing compared to what the Gazans are undergoing. And the bombardment, I mean, the amount of bombs that they have dropped on this tiny little area in 6 weeks is more than the United States dropped on all of Afghanistan at the height of the war in an entire year. Afghanistan is 100 times larger than Gaza. And it's much worse than what we went through in 1982, how horrific as that was.
When you see the attacks against the hospitals, the schools, the UN sites, what the Israelis have said is that they're trying to root out Hamas. When you see attacks on these institutions, what does your mind, what does your experience, what does your scholarship tell you is actually the goal?
Israel has posited, Israeli politicians and Israeli generals have posited as a war aim, destroying Hamas. Now, Hamas has a military wing, and it might be possible for Israel to defeat that military wing. But Hamas is a political and a cultural and a social organization and an ideology and an idea. You can't really destroy an idea with bombs. And you certainly cannot uproot and destroy the entirety of Hamas without killing a quarter or even more of the population, because it has support among a segment of the Palestinian population. So that is an unrealizable goal. I actually think what they're trying to do is punish Gaza and make up for the humiliating defeat of the 6th of October, when an entire division of the Israeli army was overrun, and when Israeli intelligence failed and Israeli surveillance techniques and Israeli containment techniques all collapsed. And the whole concept of Israeli so-called deterrence just went up in flames. And there is an understandable popular anger in Israel at the very high number of civilian casualties. But I think what's driving the government and the military is simply a desire for revenge, because they were so humiliated on the 6th. They failed to defend Israel. They failed everything that they said. Oh, separating the Gaza Strip from the West Bank will prevent us from having to negotiate. Netanyahu said that again and again. Supporting Hamas in Gaza is in our interest because it weakens the Palestinian Authority, so we don't have to negotiate. Netanyahu said that again and again. Well, that scheme has obviously failed, as has the Israeli military, as have Israeli intelligence and surveillance techniques. And I think that humiliation, as much as popular anger at the killing of so many Israeli civilians, the highest civilian death toll in Israel's history, as far as I can tell, about 719 Israelis were killed by suicide bombs during and other attacks during the Second Intifada. They lost about 800 civilians in one day. The Second Intifada went on for 3 years, and fewer Israeli civilians were killed than were killed in a day or two in this attack on the 6th of October. So the human shock and the trauma are one thing, but I think the rage and humiliation and anger and desire for revenge of the military is really why they are killing so many people.
That was Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University in New York City. He spoke with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid early last week. Since then, reports have placed the number of Palestinian casualties above 14,000. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. The Bay Area has a rich history of counter and subcultures, but that doesn't mean it's always easy to find a space to explore self-expression. Next up, we hear a story from our series, Culture Keepers, profiles of people who maintain and create such spaces.
I was very much fascinated by bells and lights and whistles.
It's my role to learn it well and protect it and keep it.
Alors, je vais faire l'explication en anglais. Soyez tolérants.
Just the energy and the drive that they have, like the future is looking fucking golden.
In this installment, we get a glimpse into a local goth scene and we learn what makes it very Bay Area. Reporter Paul C. Kelly Campos brings us into the late night world of baby bats and banshees.
A DJ named Hakoth GF has every dancer inside of Eli's Mile High Club under her spell. I survey a darkly angelic crowd. People are dressed in mostly black and silver, twirling and shifting. Red lights shine upon safety pins, thick chains, bondage gear, elegant satin, and shredded clothing. The people in the crowd hail from a broad range of ages, backgrounds, and gender identities. The thing they have in common is a deep love of goth culture.
There's like a lot of different parties and a lot of different promotions that are connected to this scene, and it's so exciting to see it flourishing.
Oh, darling. It has changed a lot over the years. We used to have the trad goth era, and I feel like we're in something new. I don't know, baby goth era.
The Bay Area's goth scene has let them shine.
I feel like it's a side of my personality that has a hard time finding a place to shine. And I feel like places like this and communities that are in the Bay Area makes me feel confident to kind of bring that side of my personality out in myself.
There are a lot of misconceptions about goth. The word itself has existed and been applied to literature and art long before it was ever associated with the subculture we now know. In history, Goths were Germanic people who helped bring about the fall of the Roman Empire. The Gothic architecture of the Middle Ages was dramatic, featuring asymmetrical buildings and high, pointed arches. Centuries later, Gothic literature took inspiration from these buildings for stories of mystery, horror, and romance. Fast forward to the music-based subculture that developed in the 1980s. If you're picturing a sulking, pale, straight white guy with teased hair in a trench coat, you might be thinking too narrowly, says DJ Hakoth GF, otherwise known as Christina C. Villanueva.
Maybe a misperception is that goths are mean or standoffish or like exclusive or whatever, but as far as my experience has gone, it's been the total opposite. Everyone's so nice and encouraging and friendly and inviting and inclusive.
Christina curates music and events by and for queer and trans people of color. She didn't grow up a diehard goth, but she listened to goth-adjacent punk and death rock. 5 years ago, she first heard the atmospheric Susie and the Banshees songs, Love and Avoid and Monitor, and she felt a sense of safety.
When I discovered Susie, I would just listen to her as I was walking on the street at night or just like around others and it, or, you know, like commuting in the world. And it really just gave me this sense of like power and almost like a veil from the rest of the world.
And what she first felt within the music, she felt in abundance from the scene itself.
I love the music. I love participating in the community. But what I love most about it and what it's meant to me is not only acceptance and inclusion in this community, but like freedom of expression and almost like encouragement to be your freakiest self.
And when she moved to the Bay Area in 2021, those feelings continue to flourish.
Here, it feels so not intimidating. It feels so welcoming and So I feel like I don't even know if Hot Goth GF as events or as my radio show or as any, even as me as a DJ would exist anywhere else. Like, I feel like the Bay is so special for really intentionally creating and uplifting communities, like through action, through creation and production and collaboration.
The transition from being a fan of gothic music to DJing the music herself came after Christina curated a playlist for the bar, The Knockout, in the Mission District.
Someone who is at the show worked at Rickshaw Stop and mentioned to me, oh, we need a DJ for a show at Rickshaw Stop. I loved the music you played. Would you be willing to DJ? And I had no idea how to DJ. I thought I would. I said, yes, of course, because I'm always going to jump on an opportunity. And that sounded like so much fun. And I was really flattered that they liked my taste.
And more and more venues booked her.
And now they're more willing to work with me because they see the community that comes through.
Like the community here at Eli's Mile High Club. Folks here say the Bay's goth scene is special.
I just came to SF, didn't know nobody. I started going down to bars, and I realized there was this whole Latinx, like, community that was, like, goth and, like, underground, and they put on hella shows.
I think it really just gives a space for people to express themselves and tell their story, you know, through whatever gothic, macabre lens they want to.
It's sexy. It's f***ing sexy. The hottest f***ing people, like, and again, they're all so f***ing nice.
Christina showcases femme and queer gothic artists.
Hot Goth GF is a meme that I always thought was really funny. And then my girlfriend started calling me her Hot Goth GF just like to be funny. And then I started collecting songs that kind of fit under this phrase Hot Goth GF as a playlist on my phone.
And once she started hosting and throwing live events herself, it became natural to refer to them as Hot Goth GF Presents.
It does sound binary, but I hope that once you start engaging with the events or once any like fan or audience member or collaborator sees what it's about, you get that it is trans inclusive, non-binary inclusive, queer inclusive in general.
Thank you, Christina Hot Goth GF, for straight up killing it. We're now transitioning into a little back-to-back for our last 30 minutes here on Lower Grand Radio.
Christina hosts a show that streams every second Sunday night on Lower Grand Radio.
Thank you for joining me, and good evening. Welcome to another episode of Hot Goth GF Radio, the show where I play punk, goth, electronic, and all dark genres, only by femme and queer artists.
On her show, she plays music and interviews key players within the goth scene.
Yeah. Bondage Agogo, at its like height of popularity, I mean, you're talking 800, 1,000 people through the door on a Wednesday night.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Oh,
and like
God.
Celebrities would come.
Including Bay Area goth legend, DJ Melting Girl. Melting Girl says goth has a decades-long relationship with the Bay Area.
One of the most classic vampire novels, Interview the Vampire, a part of that takes place in San Francisco.
Melting Girl, or Molly Venn, grew up in what she considers to be one of the golden ages of music, the 80s. She came of age listening to bands like Depeche Mode and The Cure.
Growing up in LA, I was very fortunate. We had K-Rock. Which was probably one of the best alternative radio stations in the country. And at that time, they really broke a lot of bands. I was with my friend at the time, and we were sitting in the car. Her mom went in to return the tapes, and we were just sitting in the car, and she left the engine on so we could still hear the radio. And they played Bela Lugosi's Dead by Bauhaus, and I never heard it before. And I was like, this is the most amazing song ever.
Even though she couldn't catch the name of the band or the song she heard, she got her mom to take her to Tower Records.
And so I went up to the person working at Tower, and I was like, okay, so I heard this song on the radio, and it was something about Bella something undead, undead, undead. And the guy was like, yeah, I know what song you're talking about.
Bela Lugosi is dead. The bats have left the bell tower. The victims have been bled. Red velvet lines, the black box. Bela Lugosi is dead.
It was an imported double cassette tape that cost $23. a high price for her mother to pay at the time. But it introduced Molly to a community that she felt accepted by.
For me, I never felt like I fit in. And once I started going to the goth clubs, I was like, these are my people. And suddenly I had friends.
Melting Girl has been working as a DJ and promoter since 1994. She's one of the resident DJs at the weekly goth club, Death Guild, at San Francisco's DNA Lounge. It's the longest running weekly goth and industrial genre club in the world, previously preceded only by London's Slimelight. Their motto is, a club for the people, by the people.
We now know people who've met at Death Guild, gotten married, had children, and their kids have shown up at Death Guild. Like, it's been a full life cycle.
And she's had to change with the times.
I mean, when I started, all I had to do was make a flyer, maybe run an ad in a local paper. You know, we had SF Weekly and Bay Guardian back then.
Today's scene depends a lot on social media.
You know, some people it comes very natural to. Some people have an easier time than others. Personally, I really struggle with it.
But she did start a Twitch channel in 2020 that she continues to host twice a week, live from her home.
All I really want to do is play music for people. Show up at the club, play that song, and then see everyone dancing to it and then just be like, yes! Like, that's what I love.
I don't know, this may sound kind of old school, but there is something deep and innate about people that requires community that the internet is not yet able to fulfill.
That's Vampi Hurtado Zafra, and we are at the DIY cultural space she's working to permit and open in San Francisco, the Enzyme Cultural Center. The atrium of the room is overflowing with tools, ladders, and paints.
And so spaces like this, or endeavoring to make spaces like this, even though they're not necessarily profitable in the schema of capitalism at all, is absolutely necessary and something that cities and communities require, individual people require.
Vampi has been working as a goth DJ and promoter for more than a decade and has performed in gothic drag for a little more than a year. Vampi blends traditional goth and dark wave with cumbia, perreo, reggaeton, and dembow into her sets.
You're listening and following your heart and following the beat. And like when the beat is there, it just flows. And so I can't really describe that process because it's like not something I can speak with words, but it's something I feel. And so you just kind of feel when something wants to be with something.
She organizes the goth club, The Batcave, at the Knockout. But this innovative blend of Latinx and gothic genres hasn't always been received warmly outside of the Bay.
Interestingly, like going and playing internationally, I would start mixing cumbia into my sets, like cumbia specifically, and they'd be like, what the f*** are you doing? Like, this makes zero sense. This is a goth club. Like, why would you do that? And I'm sitting there like defending myself, you know, and I'm just like, I don't know. This is what we do in San Francisco and people have fun doing that. I'm sharing it with you. That's cool. If you don't like it, you don't have to.
Not everyone is friendly to the scene, so promoters have to be careful. I'm getting a text for the location of a secret rave. The community and rave organizers decide who can be trusted. Only those people get updates for where shows will be. I've arrived at the Renegade. It's an occasional underground event. The bill clearly states there's no drama, creeps, cops, or non-consensual contact allowed. Hot Goth GF is one of the organizers and DJs.
If there is an emergency, there's people you can talk to. We want to help you mitigate any kind of abusive or just like not cool interactions that you have, you know, whether it's with a creep or whether your abuser shows up. Like, now I have policies in place so that guests know there's a path for me to take if something like this happens rather than dealing with it themselves.
Hakoth GF recently received a grant from the Center for Cultural Innovation to continue to produce these events and pay a diverse array of performing artists.
I love the baby bats. I love the baby gays, the baby goths. It's not all just coming from one perspective or, you know, one voice, you know, the cis, straight, hetero voice that might be the dominant voice of traditional goth or even like goth throughout the years. Finding and appreciating and platforming goth artists from other cultures is so important to me, and I think what keeps the music interesting.
And it's easy to hear everything that's interesting and beautiful about it. Standing soaked in blue moonlight, listening to the Bay Area's goth community blare music that shakes the cold air. In San Francisco, I'm Paul C. Kelly Campos for Cross Currents.
Paul is a graduate of our summer journalism training program. You can find more stories from our series Culture Keepers at kelw.org/culturekeepers. Today's Cross Currents team includes Pat McMahon, Molly Blair Salyer, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.